them of him until the case became unanswerable, then fought off his apologists when it became unfaceable. Why do I begin to understand him? He wondered, marvelling at his own tolerance. Why is it that in my heart, if not my intellect, I sense a stirring of sympathy for the man who all his life has made a failure of my successes? What I made him do, he made me pay for. You brought it on yourself, Belinda had said. Then why was it that, as with his dangling arm at the moment he was shot to pieces, he had yet to feel the pain? He's in Prague, he thought. The chase game of the last few days was a Czech fan dance to keep us looking the wrong way while they smuggled him to safety. Mary would never have gone there unless Magnus was ahead of her. Mary would never have gone there, period. Would she? Wouldn't she? He didn't know, and he wouldn't have trusted anybody who said they did. To leave Plush and all her Englishness behind? For Magnus, now? She'd never do it. Oh, she'd do it for Magnus. Tom will come first for her. She'll stay. She'll take Tom with her. I need a woman. An all-night coffee shop stood at the corner of Half Moon Street, and on other early mornings, Brotherhood might have stopped there and let the tired whores make a fuss of his dog, and Brotherhood, in return, would have made a fuss of the whores, bought them a coffee and chatted them up, because he liked their tradecraft and their guts and their mixture of human canniness and stupidity. But his dog was dead, and so for the time being was his sense of fun. He unlocked his door and headed for the sideboard where the vodka was. He poured himself a warm half-tumbler and drank it down. He ran a bath, switched on his transistor radio, and took it to the bathroom. The news reported disasters everywhere, but no British diplomatic couple surfacing in Prague. If the Czechs want to blow the whistle, they'll do it at midday in order to catch the evening television and tomorrow's papers, he thought. He began shaving. The phone was ringing. It's Nigel saying we found him. He was at his club all the time. It's the duty officer reporting that the Prague Foreign Ministry has put out a midday press call for foreign correspondents. It's Steggy, saying he likes strong men. He switched off the radio, walked naked to the drawing room, snatched up the receiver, said yes, and heard a ping. Then nothing. He pressed his lips together as a warning to himself not to speak. He was praying. He was definitely praying. Speak, he prayed. Say something. Then he heard it. Three short taps of a coin or a nail file on the drum of the mouthpiece. Prague procedures. Casting round for something metal, he saw his fountain pen on the writing table and managed to seize it without relinquishing the phone. He tapped once in return. I am reading you. Two more taps. Then three again. Stay where you are, said the message. I have information for you. With his pen, he gave four taps to the mouthpiece and heard two in reply before the caller rang off. He ran his fingers through his stubble hair. He took his vodka to the desk and sat down, put his face in his hands. Keep alive, he prayed. It's the networks. It's Pym putting it all right. Keep clever. I'm here, if that's what you're asking. I'm here and waiting for your next signal. Don't call again until you're ready. The phone screamed a second time. He lifted the receiver, but it was only Nigel. Pym's description and photograph were on their way to every police station in the country, he said. The firm was switching to the operational telephone lines only. Beau had ordered the Whitehall lines disconnected. The press contacts were already beating down the doors. Why is he talking to me? Brotherhood wondered. Is he lonely, or is he giving me a chance to say I've just had this funny phone call from a Joe using Prague procedures? It's the funny call, he decided. Some joker just phoned me with a Czech call sign, he said. I gave him the signal to speak, but he wouldn't. God alone knows what it was about. Well, if anything comes through, let us know at once. Use the operational line. So you said Brotherhood. Waiting again. Thinking of every Joe who would ever come through Badland. Take your time, move carefully and with confidence, Don't panic. Don't run. Take your time. Pick your phone box. He heard a knock at the door. It's some bloody hawker. Kate's taken her overdose. It's that fool Arab boy who lives downstairs and always thinks my bathroom's leaking on him. He pulled on a dressing gown, opened the door, and saw Mary. He hauled her inside and slammed the door. Whatever seized him after that, he didn't know. Relief or fury, remorse or indignation. He slapped her once, then he slapped her again. And on a clear day, he would have taken her straight to bed. "There's a place called Farley Abbott near Exeter," she said. "What of it?" Magnus told him he'd put his mother in a house beside the sea in Devon. Told who? Poppy, his Czech controller. They were students together in Bern. He thinks Magnus is going to kill himself. I suddenly realized. That's what's in the burn box with the secrets. The station gun, isn't it?
How do you know it's Farley Abbott?
He talked about his mother in Devon. He hasn't got a bloody mother. His only place in Devon is Farley Abbott. When I was in Devon, he'd say, let's go to Devon for a holiday. It was Farley Abbott always. We never went, and he stopped talking about it. Rick used to take him there from school. They used to picnic and bicycle on the beach. It's one of his ideal places. He's there with a woman. I know he is. Chapter 15. You will imagine Tom with what glory in his youthful heart the brilliant intelligence officer and lover celebrated the completion of his 2 years of devoted service to the flag in distant Austria and set about returning to civilian England. His leave-taking from Sabina was not as heart-rending as he had feared, for as the day approached, she feigned a Slav indifference to his departure. "I shall be happy woman, Magnus. Your English wives will not make sour faces at me. I shall be economist and free woman, not the courtesan of a frivolous soldier." Nobody had ever called Pym frivolous before. She even took herself on leave ahead of him to forestall the agony of parting. "She is being brave," Pym told himself. His farewell from Axel, though haunted by rumours of fresh purges, had a similarly rounded feel to it.
"Sir Magnus, whatever happens to me, we have done a great work together," he said, as in the evening light they faced each other outside the barn that had become Pym's second home. "Never forget you owe me $200.
"I never will," Pym said. He began the long walk back to Sergeant Kaufman's jeep. He turned to wave, but Axel had vanished into the forest. The $200 were a reminder of their increasing closeness during the final months of their relationship.
"My father's pressing me for money again," Pym had said one evening, while they photographed a code book he had borrowed from Membury's cricket locker.
"The Burmese police are proposing to arrest him."
"Then send it to him," Axel had replied, winding back the film of his camera. He slipped the film in his pocket and inserted a fresh one.
"How much does he want?"
"Whatever it is, I haven't got it. I'm a subaltern on 13 shillings a day, not a millionaire."
Axel had appeared to pay no further interest, and they turned instead to the topic of Sergeant Pavel. Axel said it was time to stage a fresh crisis in Pavel's life.
"But he had a crisis only last month," Pym had objected. "His wife threw him out of his apartment for drunkenness, and we had to help him buy his way in again."
"We need a crisis," Axel had repeated firmly. "Vienna is beginning to take him for granted, and I do not care for the tone of their follow-up questions."
Pym found Membury sitting at his desk. The afternoon sun was shining on one side of his friendly head while he read a fish book.
"I'm afraid Greensleeves wants a bonus of $200 cash," he said.
"But my dear chap, we've paid him a lot of money this month already. What on earth can he want $200 for?"
"He's got to buy his daughter an abortion. The doctor only takes US dollars and it's getting urgent."
"But the child's a mere 14. Who's the man? They ought to throw him into prison."
"It's that Russian captain from headquarters.
The pig. The utter swine."
"Pavel's a Roman Catholic too, you know," Pym reminded him. "Not a very good one, I agree, but it's not easy for him either."
The next night, Pym counted $200 across the barn table. Axel tossed them back at him.
"For your father," he said. "A loan from me to you."
"I can't do that. Those are operational funds."
"Not anymore. They belong to Sergeant Pavel."
Pym still did not pick up the money.
"And Sergeant Pavel lends them to you as your friend,"
Axel said, tearing a sheet of paper from his notebook.
"Here, write me an IOU. Sign it, and one day I shall make you pay it back."
Pym rode away in good heart, confident that Graz and all its responsibilities, like Bern, would cease to exist the moment he entered the first tunnel. Laying down his arms at the Intelligence Corps depot in Sussex, Pym was handed the following private and confidential letter by the demobilization officer. "The Government Overseas Research Group, P.O. Box 777, the Foreign Office, London, SW1. Dear Pym, mutual friends in Austria have passed your name to me as someone who might be interested in longer-term employment. If this is so, would you care to lunch with me at the Travellers Club for an informal chat on Friday the 19th at 12:45? Signed, Sir Alwyn Leith, CMG. For several days, a mysterious squeamishness held Pym back from replying. "I need new horizons," he told himself. "They are good people, but limited." Feeling strong one morning, he wrote, regretting he was considering a career in the church.
"There's always Shell, Magnus," said Belinda's mother, who had taken Pym's future much to heart. "Belinda's got an uncle in Shell, haven't you, darling?"
"He wants to do something worthwhile, Mummy," Belinda said, stamping her foot and making the breakfast table rattle.
"Time somebody did," said Belinda's father from behind his telegraph,
and for some reason found this very funny, and went on laughing through his gapped teeth, while Belinda stormed into the garden in a rage. A more interesting contender for Pym's services was Kenneth Sefton Boyd, who had come into an inheritance and was proposing that he and Pym should open a nightclub. Keeping this intelligence from Belinda, who had views on nightclubs and the Sefton Boyds, Pym pleaded an engagement at his old school and took himself to the family estate in Scotland, where Jemima met him at the station. She was driving the very Land Rover from which she had glowered at him when they were children. She was more beautiful than ever. "How was Austria?" she asked, as they bumped cheerfully over purple highlands towards a monstrous Victorian castle.
"Super," said Pym.
"Did you box and play rugby all the time?"
"Well, not all the time, actually," Pym confessed.
Jemima cast him a look of protracted interest. The Sefton Boyds lived in a parentless world. A disapproving retainer served them dinner. Afterwards they played backgammon until Jemima was tired. Pym's bedroom was as large as a football field, and as cold. Sleeping lightly, he woke without stirring to see a dismembered red spark switching like a firefly across the darkness. The spark descended and disappeared. A pale shape advanced on him. He smelt cigarette and toothpaste, and felt Jemima's naked body arrange itself softly round him, and Jemima's lips find his own. "You won't mind if we turf you out on Friday, will you?" said Jemima, while the three breakfasted in bed from a tray brought in by Sefton Boyd. "Only we've got Mark coming for the weekend."
"Who's Mark?" said Pym.
"Well, I'm going to sort of marry him, actually," said Jemima. "I'd marry Kenneth if I could, but he's so conventional about those things."
Renouncing women, Pym wrote to the British Council, offering to distribute culture among primitives, and to his old housemaster, Willow, asking for a position teaching German. "I greatly miss the school's discipline, and have felt a keen loyalty towards it ever since my father failed to pay my fees." He wrote to Murgo, booking himself in for an extended retreat, though he had the prudence to be vague about dates. He wrote to the Catholics of Farm Street, asking to continue the instruction he had begun in Graz. He wrote to an English school in Geneva, and an American school in Heidelberg, and to the BBC, all in a spirit of self-negation. He wrote to the Inns of Court about opportunities for reading law. When he had thus surrounded himself with a plethora of choices, he filled in an enormous form,
detailing his brilliant life till now, and followed it to the Oxford Appointments Board in search of more. The morning was sunny. His old university city dazzled him with carefree memories of his days as a communist informer. His interlocutor was whimsical, if not downright fey. He pushed his spectacles to the top of his nose. He shoved them into his greying locks like an effeminate racing driver. He gave Pym sherry and put a hand on his backside in order to propel him to a long window which gave onto a row of council houses. "How about a life in filthy industry?" he suggested.
"Industry would be fine," said Pym.
"Not unless you like eating with the crew. Do you like eating with the crew?"
"I'm really not very class-conscious, actually, sir."
"How charming. And do you like having grease up to your elbows?"
Pym said he didn't mind grease either, actually. But by then he was being guided to a second window that gave on to spires and a lawn.
"I've a menial librarianship at the British Museum and a sort of third assistant clerkship to the House of Commons, which is the proletarian version of the Lords. I've bits and bobs in Kenya, Malaya, and the Sudan. I can do you nothing in India. They've taken it away from me. Do you like abroad or hate it?"
Pym said abroad was super. He had been to university in Bern.
His interlocutor was puzzled.
"I thought you went to university here."
"Here too," said Pym.
"Ah.
Now, do you like danger?"
"I love it, actually."
"You poor boy. Don't keep saying actually.
And will you give unquestioning allegiance to whoever is rash enough to employ you?"
"I will."
"Will you adore your country, right or wrong, so help you God and the Tory party?"
"I will again," said Pym, laughing. "Do you also believe that to be born British is to be born a winner in the great lottery of life?"
"Well, yes. To be honest, that too."
"Then be a spy," his interlocutor suggested, and drew from his desk yet another application form and handed it to Pym. "Jack Brotherhood sends his love and says why on earth haven't you been in touch with him, and why won't you have lunch with his nice recruiter?"
"I could write whole essays for you, Tom, on the voluptuous pleasures of being interviewed." Of all the arts of affiliation Pym mastered and throughout his life improved upon, the interview must stand in first place. We didn't have office-tricked cyclists in those days, as your Uncle Jack likes to call them. We didn't have anybody who wasn't himself a citizen of the secret world, blessed with the unlined innocence of privilege. The nearest they had come to life's experience was the war, and they saw the peace as its continuation by other means. Yet in the terms of the world outside their heads, they had led lives so untested, so childlike and tender in their simplicities, so inward in their connections, that they required echelons of cutouts to reach the society they honestly believed they were protecting. Pym sat before them, calm, reflective, resolute, modest. Pym composed his features in one mould after another, now of reverence, now of awe, zeal, passionate sincerity, or spiritual good humour. He paraded pleasurable surprise when he heard that his tutors thought the world of him, and a stern-jawed pride on learning that the army loved him too. He modestly demurred, or modestly boasted. He weeded out the half-believers from the believers, and did not rest until he had converted the pack of them to paid-up life membership of the Pym Supporters Club.
"Now, tell us about your father, will you, Pym?" said a man with a droopy moustache, uncomfortably reminiscent of Axel's. "Sounds a bit of a colourful sort of type to me."
Pym smiled ruefully, sensing the mood. Pym delicately faltered before rallying.
"I'm afraid he's a bit too colourful sometimes, sir," he said, amid a hubble-bubble of male laughter. "I don't see a lot of him, to be honest. We're still friends, but I rather steer clear of him. I have to, actually."
"Yes. Well, I don't think we can hold you responsible for the sins of your old man, can we?" said the same questioner, indulgently. "It's you we're interviewing, not your papa."
How much did they know of Rick, or care? Even today I can only guess, for the question was never raised again, and I'm sure that in any formal way it went forgotten within days of Pym's acceptance. English gentlemen, after all, do not discriminate against each other on the grounds of parentage, only of breeding. Occasionally they must have read of one of Rick's more lurid collapses, and perhaps allowed themselves an amused smile. Here and there, presumably, word trickled down to them by way of their commercial contacts. But my suspicion is that Rick was an asset. A healthy streak of criminality in a young spy's background never did him any harm, they reasoned. Grown up in a hard school, they told one another. Could be useful. The last question of the interview, and Pym's answer, echo forever in my head. A military man in tweeds put it.
Look here, young Pym, he demanded, with a thrust of his bucolic head. You're by way of being a Czech buff. Speak their language a bit, know their people. What do you say to these purges and arrests they're having over there? Worry you?
I think the purges are quite appalling, sir, but they are to be expected, said Pym, fixing his earnest gaze upon a distant, unreachable star.
Why expected? Demanded the military man, as if nothing ought to be.
It's a rotten system. It's superimposed on tribalism. It can only survive by the exercise of oppression.
Yes, 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 granted. So what would you do about it?
Do?
In what capacity, sir? As one of us, you fool. Officer of this service. Anyone can talk. We do.
Pym had no need to think. His patent sincerity was out there speaking for him already.
I'd play their game, sir. I'd divide them against themselves. Spread rumour, false accusation, suspicion. I'd let dog eat dog.
You mean you wouldn't mind getting innocent chaps chucked into prison by their own police, then?
Being a bit harsh, aren't you? Bit immoral?
Not if it shortens the life of the system. No, sir, I don't think I am. And I'm not persuaded about the innocence of these men of yours either, I'm afraid.
In life, says Proust, we end up doing whatever we do second best.
What Pym might have done better, I shall never know. He accepted the firm's offer. He opened his Times and read with a similar detachment of his engagement to Belinda. That's me taken care of, then, he thought. With the firm getting one half of me and Belinda the other, I'll never want for anything again.
Turn your eye to Pym's first great wedding, Tom. It occurs, largely without his participation, in the last months of training, in a break between silent killing and a 3-day seminar entitled Know Your Enemy, led by a vibrant young tutor from the London School of Economics. Imagine Pym's enjoyment of this unlikely preparation for his marriage state. The fun of it. The freewheeling unreality. He has chased Buchan's ghost across the moors of Argyle. He has messed about in rubber boats, made night landings on sandy shores, with hot chocolate awaiting him in the vanquished enemy's headquarters. He has fallen out of aeroplanes, dipped into secret inks, learned Morse, and tapped scatological radio signals into the bracing Scottish air. He has watched a mosquito aeroplane glide 100 feet above him through the darkness, dropping a box full of boulders in place of genuine supplies. He has played secret games of fox and geese in the streets of Edinburgh, photographed innocent citizens without their knowledge, fired live bullets at pop-up targets in simulated drawing rooms, and plunged his dagger into the midriff of a swinging sandbag, all for England and King Harry. In spells of quiet, he has been dispatched to Genteel Bath to improve his check at the feet of an ancient lady called Frau Kohl, who lives in a crescent house of impoverished splendour. Over tea and toasted muffins, Frau Kohl shows him albums of her childhood in Karlsbad, now called Kalevivaari.
But you know Kalevivaari very well, Mr. Sanderstedt, she cries, when Pym shows off his knowledge. You have been there, yes?
No, says Pym, but I have a friend who has.
Then back to base camp, somewhere in Scotland, to resume the red thread of violence that has been spun into every new thing he is learning. This violence is not only of the body. It is the ravishment that must be done to truth, friendship, and, if need be, honour, in the interests of Mother England. We are the chaps who do the dirty work so that purer souls can sleep in bed at night. Pym, of course, has heard these arguments before from the Michaels, but now he must hear them again from his new employers, who make pilgrimages from London
in order to warn the uncut young of the wily foreigners they will one day have to tangle with. Do you remember your own visit, Jack? A gala night it was, close to Christmas. The Great Brotherhood is coming. We had streamers hanging from the rafters. You sat at the directing staff's table in the excellent canteen, while we young'uns craned our necks to catch a glimpse of one of the great players of the game. After dinner, we gathered round you in a half-circle, clutching our subsidized port, and you told us tales of derring-do until we crept off to bed and dreamed of being like you. Though, alas, we could never really have your lovely war, even if that was what we were rehearsing for. Do you remember how in the morning, before you left, you called on Pym while he was shaving, and congratulated him on a damn good showing so far? "Nice girl you're marrying, too," you said. "Oh, do you know her, sir?" said Pym. "Just good reports," you said complacently. Then off you went, confident you had scattered a pinch more stardust in Pym's eyes. Which you had, Jack. You had. Except that what goes up with Pym has a way of coming down. And it annoyed him to discover that his impending marriage had received the firm's approval while it still awaited his.
"So what exactly are you doing for a living, old boy? Don't quite understand," Belinda's father asked, not for the first time, during a discussion about whom to invite.
"It's a government-sponsored language lab, sir," said Pym, in accordance with the firm's sketchy guidelines on cover. "We work out exchanges of academics from various countries and arrange courses for them."
"Sounds more like the Secret Service to me," said Belinda's father,
with that queer, cracked laugh of his that always seemed to know too much. To his future spouse, on the other hand, Pym told everything he knew about his work, and more. He showed her how he could break her windpipe with a single blow, and put her eyes out with two fingers easily, and how she could smash the small bones in someone's foot if they were annoying her under the table. He told her everything that made him a secret hero of England, seeing the world right, single-handed.
"So how many people have you killed?" Belinda asked him grimly, discounting those that he had merely maimed.
"I'm not allowed to say," said Pym, and with a crisping of the jaw, stared away from her towards the stark wastelands of his duty.
"Well, don't then," said Belinda. "And don't tell Daddy anything, or he'll tell Mummy."
"Dear Jemima," Pym wrote on an off chance a week before his great day,
"it seems so odd we are both getting married within a month of each other. I keep wondering whether we are doing the right thing. I'm sick of the boring work I'm doing and considering a change. I love you. Magnus."
Pym waited eagerly for the mail and scanned the moors around the training camp for a sight of her Land Rover as she dashed over the horizon to save him. But nothing came, and by the eve of his wedding he was left with himself again, walking the night streets of London and pretending they reminded him of Carlo Vivari.
"And what a husband he was, Tom! What a match was celebrated! Priests of upper-class humility. The great church, famed for its permanence and previous successes. The frugal reception in a tomb-like Bayswater hotel. And there at the centre of the throng, our Prince Charming himself, chatting brilliantly to the crowned heads of suburbia. Pym forgot no one's name, was fluent and informative on the subject of government-sponsored language laboratories, vouchsafed Belinda long and tender glances. All this, at least, until somebody switched off the soundtrack, Pym's included, and the faces of his audience turned mysteriously away from him, looking for the cause of breakdown. Suddenly the interconnecting doors at the far end of the room, until now locked, were flung open by unseen hands, and Pym knew in his toes at once, just by the timing and the pause and by the way people parted before the empty space, that somebody had rubbed the lamp. Two waiters entered, with the grace of well-tipped men, bearing trays of uncorked bubbly and charges of smoked salmon, though Belinda's mother had not ordered smoked salmon, and had decreed that no champagne be served before the toast to the bride and groom. After that, it was the Gulworth election all over again, because first Mr. Muspole appeared, followed by a thin man with a razor slash,
and each commandeered a doorpost as Rick swept between them in full Ascot rig, leaning backwards and holding his arms wide and smiling everywhere at once. "Hello, old son, don't you recognise your old pal? Have this one on me, boys. Where's that bride of his? By Jove, son, she's a beauty. Come here, my dear. Give your old father-in-law a kiss. My God, there's some flesh here, son. Where have you been hiding her all these years?" One on each arm, Rick marched the nuptial pair to the hotel forecourt, where a brand new Jaguar car, painted liberal yellow, stood parked in everybody's way, with white wedding ribbons tied to the bonnet, and a mile-high bunch of Harrods gardenias crammed into the passenger seat, and Mr. Cudlove at the wheel, with a carnation in his mulberry buttonhole. "Seen one of those before, then, son? You know what it is? It's your old man's gift to both of you, and nobody will ever take it away from you as long as I'm spared. Cuddy's going to drive you wherever you want to go and leave it with you. Aren't you, Cuddy?"
"I wish you both all good fortune in your chosen walk of life, sir," Mr. Cudlove said, his loyal eyes filling with tears. Of Rick's long speech, I remember only that it was beautiful and modest and free of all hyperbole, and rested upon the theme that when two young people love each other, us old uns who have had their day should stand aside, because if anyone has deserved it, they have. Pym never saw the car again, and it was a long while before he saw Rick either, because when they went back outside, Mr. Cudlove and the yellow Jaguar had vanished, and two very obvious plain-clothes police detectives were talking in low tones to the confused hotel manager. But I have to tell you, Tom, that it was the best of our wedding presents, barring perhaps the posy of red poppies, thrust into Pym's arms without a card or explanation by a man in a Polish-looking Burberry raincoat, as Pym and Belinda rode into the sunset for a week at Eastbourne. "Put him into the field while he's unsullied," says personnel, who has a way of speaking about people as if they weren't seated across the desk from him. Pym is trained. Pym is complete. Pym is armed and ready, and only one question remains. What mantle shall he wear? What disguise shall cover the secret frame of his maturity? In a series of unconsummated interviews reminiscent of the Oxford Appointments Board, personnel unlocks a bedlam of possibilities. Pym will be a freelance writer. But can he write, and will Fleet Street have him? With disarming openness, Pym is marched through the offices of most of our great national newspapers, whose editors inanely pretend they do not know where he has come from, or why, though henceforth they will know him forever as a creature of the firm, and he them. He is already halfway to stardom with the Telegraph, when a fifth-floor genius has a better plan. "Look here, how would you like to join up with the comms again? Trade on your old allegiances, get yourself a billet in the international left-wing set. We've always wanted to chuck a stone into that pond."
"It sounds fascinating," says Pym, as he sees himself selling Marxism Today on street corners for the rest of his life. A more ambitious plan is to get him into Parliament, where he can keep an eye on some of these fellow-travelling MPs.
"Any particular preference as to party, or aren't we fussy?" asks personnel, still in tweeds from his weekend in Wiltshire.
"I'd rather prefer it not to be the Liberals, if it's all the same to you," says Pym. But nothing lasts long in politics, and a week later, Pym is destined for one of the private banks, whose directors wander in and out of the firm's head office all day long, moaning about Russian gold and the need to protect our trade routes from the Bolsheviks. At the Institute of Directors, Pym is lunched by a succession of captains of finance, who think they may have an opening.
"I knew Pym," says one, over a second brandy, or a third. "Kept a dirty great office in Mount Street somewhere. Best man at his job I ever knew."
"What was his job, sir?" Pym asks politely.
"Con man," says his host, with a horsey laugh. "Any relation?"
"Must be my distant, wicked uncle," says Pym, laughing also, and hurries back to the sanctuary of the firm. On goes the dance. How seriously, I'll never know, for Pym is not yet privy to these backstage deliberations. though it isn't for want of peeking into a few desk drawers and locked steel cupboards. Then suddenly the mood changes.
"Look here," says Personnel, trying to hide his aggravation. "Why the devil didn't you remind us you spoke Czech?"
Within a month, Pym is attached to an electrical engineering company in Gloucester as a management trainee, no previous experience necessary. The managing director, to his lasting regret, was at school with the firm's reigning chief, and has made the mistake of accepting a series of valuable government contracts at a time when he needed them. Pym is given to the export department, charged with opening up the East European market. His first mission is nearly his last.
"Well, why don't you just sort of take a general swing through Czecho and test the market?" says Pym's notional employer, wanly. And beneath his breath, "And do please remember that whatever else you get up to is nothing to do with us, will you?"
"A quick in and out," Pym's controller tells him gaily, in the safe house in Camberwell, where cub agents receive their operational briefing before cutting their milk teeth. He hands Pym a portable typewriter, with hidden cavities in the carriage.
"I know it seems silly," says Pym, "but I can't actually type."
"Everyone can type a bit," says Pym's controller. "Practice over the weekend."
Pym flies to Vienna.
"Memories, memories."
Pym hires a car. Pym crosses the border without the smallest difficulty, expecting to see Axel waiting for him the other side. The countryside was Austrian and beautiful. Many barns lay beside many lakes. In Pilsen, Pym toured a despondent factory in the company of square-faced men. In the evening, he kept the safety of his hotel, watched by a pair of secret policemen, who drank one coffee apiece until he went to bed. His next calls were in the north. On the road to Usti, he saw army lorries and memorized their unit insignia. To the east of Usti lay a factory that the firm suspected of producing isotope containers. Pym was unclear what an isotope was, or what it should be contained in, but he drew a sketch of the main buildings and hid it in his typewriter. Next day he continued to Prague, and at the arranged hour sat himself in the famous Tin Church, which has a window looking into Kafka's old apartment. Tourists and officials wandered about unsmiling. "So K began to move off slowly," Pym read, as he sat in the south aisle, third row from the altar. K felt forlorn and isolated as he advanced between the rows of empty pews, with the priest's eyes fixed on him for all he knew. Needing a rest, Pym knelt down and prayed. With a grunt and a puff, a heavy man shuffled in beside him and sat down. Pym smelt garlic and thought of Sergeant Pavel. Through a crack in his fingers, he identified the recognition signals. Smear of white paint on left fingernail. Splash of blue on left cuff. A mass of disgraceful black hair. Black coat. "My contact is an artist," he realized. "Why didn't I think of that before?" But Pym did not sit back. He did not ease the little package from his pocket as a prelude to laying it between them on the pew. He remained kneeling and soon discovered why he had done so. The sound of trained feet was crunching towards him down the aisle. The footsteps stopped. A male voice said, "Come with us, please," in Czech. With a sigh of resignation, Pym's neighbour clambered wearily to his feet and followed them out. "Sheer coincidence," Pym's controller assured him, much amused when he got back. "He's already been on to us. They were pulling him in for routine questioning. He comes up for one every 6 weeks. Never even crossed their minds he might be making a clandestine pickup, let alone with a chap your age."
"You don't think he's, well, told them?" Pym said.
"Old Kirill? Blown you? Must be joking. Don't worry. We'll give you another shot in a few weeks' time."
Rick was not pleased to hear of Pym's contribution to the British export drive, and told him so on one of his secret visits from Ireland, where he had established his winter quarters while he cleared up certain misunderstandings with Scotland Yard and fought his way into the crowded new profession of West End property evictions.
"Working as a commercial traveller, my own boy," he exclaimed, to the alarm of the adjoining tables,
Selling electric shavers to a bunch of foreign communists? We did all that, son. It's over. What did I pay your education for? Where's your patriotism?
They're not electric shavers, father. I sell alternators, oscillators and sparking plugs. How's your glass?
Hostility towards Rick was a new and giddying notion for Pym. He vented it cautiously, but with growing excitement. If they ate a meal, he insisted on paying, in order to savour Rick's disapproval at seeing his own boy put down good money, where a signature would have done the trick.
"You're not mixed up with some racket out there, are you?" said Rick.
"The doors of tolerance only open a certain distance, you know, son. Even for you. What are you up to? Tell us."
The pressure on Pym's arm was suddenly dangerous. He made a joke of it, smiling broadly.
"Hey, father, that hurts," he said, awfully amused.
It was Rick's thumbnail that he was most aware of, boring into an artery.
"Could you possibly stop doing that, father?" he said. "It really is uncomfortable."
Rick was too busy pursing his lips and shaking his head. He was saying it was a damned shame when a father who had given up everything for his own son was treated like a poor ayah. He meant pariah, but the notion had never properly formed in him. Placing his elbow on the table, Pym relaxed his whole arm and let it ride about with Rick's pressure, flop one way, flop the other, then abruptly stiffened it, and exactly as he had been taught, smacked the fat of Rick's knuckles onto the table edge, causing the glasses to jump and the cutlery to dance and slide off the table. Taking back his bruised hand, Rick turned away to bestow a resigned smile on his subjects, feasting round him. Then with his good hand, he lightly pinged the edge of his Drambuie glass, to indicate that he required another nice touch. Just as by unlacing his shoes, he used to let it be known that somebody should fetch his bedroom slippers. Or by rolling onto his back, after a lengthy banquet and spreading his knees, he declared a carnal appetite. Yet, as ever, nothing is one thing for long with Pym, and soon a strange calm begins to replace his early nervousness as he continues his secret missions. The silent, unlit country that at first sight appeared so threatening to him becomes a secret womb where he can hide himself, rather than a place of dread. He has only to cross the border for the walls of his English prisons to fall away. No Belinda, no Rick, and very nearly no firm either. I am the travelling executive of an electronics company. I am Sir Magnus, roving free. His solitary nights in unpeopled provincial towns, where at first the yapping of a dog had been enough to bring him sweating to his window, now inspire him with a sense of protection. The air of universal oppression that hangs over the entire country enfolds him in its mysterious embrace. Not even the prison walls of his public school had given him such a sense of security. On car and train rides through river valleys, over hills capped by Bohemian castles, he drifts through realms of such inner contentment that the very cattle seem to be his friends. "I shall settle here," he decides. "This is my true home. How foolish of me to have supposed that Axel could ever leave it for another." He begins to relish his stilted conversations with officials. His heart leaps when he unlocks a smile from their faces. He takes pride in his slowly filling order book, feels a fatherly responsibility for his oppressors. Even his operational detours, when he is not blocking them from his mind, can be squeezed beneath the broad umbrella of his munificence. "I am a champion of the middle ground," he tells himself, using an old phrase of Axel's, as he prizes a loose stone from a wall, fishes out one package, and replaces it with another. "I am giving succor to a wounded land." Yet even with all this preliminary self-conditioning, it takes another 6 journeys on Pym's part before he can coax Axel out of the shadows of his perilous existence.
"Mr. Canterbury, are you all right, Mr. Canterbury? Answer!"
"Of course I'm all right, Miss D. I'm always all right. What is it?"
Pym pulled back the door. Miss Dubber was standing in the darkness, her hair in papers, holding Toby for protection.
"You thump so, Mr. Canterbury. You grind your teeth. An hour ago you were humming. We're worried that you're ill."
"Who's we?" said Pym sharply.
"Toby and me, you silly man.
Do you think I've got a lover?
Pym closed the door on her and went swiftly to the window. One parked van, probably green. One parked car, white or grey, Devon registration. An early milkman he had not seen before. He returned to the door, put his ear to it, and listened intently. A creak, a slippered footstep. He pulled the door open. Miss Dubba was halfway down the corridor.
Miss D, that's Mr. Canterbury. Has anybody been asking you questions about me? Why should they, Mr. Canterbury?
I don't know. Sometimes people just do, have they?
It's time you slept, Mr. Canterbury. I don't mind how much the country needs you. It can always wait another day.
The town of Strakonice is more famous for its manufacture of motorcycles and oriental fezes than for any great cultural gem. Pym made his way there because he had filled a dead letterbox in Písek, 19 kilometres to the northeast, and firm tradecraft required he should not register his presence in a target town where a dead letterbox was waiting to be cleared. So he drove to Strakonice, feeling flat and bored, which was how he always felt after a bit of firm's business, and booked himself into an ancient hotel with a grand staircase, then drifted round the town, trying to admire the old butcher's shops on the south side of the square, and the Renaissance church, which, according to his guidebook, had been changed to Baroque, and the church of St. Wenceslas, which, though originally Gothic, had been altered in the 19th century. Having exhausted these excitements, and feeling even wearier from the long heat of the summer's day, he trudged up the stairs to his bedroom, thinking how pleasant it would be if they were leading him to Sabina's apartment in Graz, in the days when he had been a penniless young double agent, without a care in the world. He put his key in the keyhole, but it was not locked. He was not unduly surprised by this, for it was still the evening hour when servants turned back bed covers, and secret policemen took a last look round. Pym stepped inside and discerned, half hidden behind a sloping shaft of sunlight from the window, the figure of Axel, waiting as the old wait, his domed head propped against the chair's back, pitched a little sideways, so that he could make out, among the lights and shades, who was coming in. And not in all the firm's unarmed combat lessons and dagger play lessons and close contact shooting lessons had anybody thought to teach Pym how to terminate the life of an emaciated friend seated behind a sunbeam. Axel was prison pale and a stone lighter. Pym could not have supposed, from his parting memory of him, that he had more flesh to give. But the purgers and interrogators and jailers had managed to find it, as they usually do, and they had helped themselves to it in handfuls. They had taken it from his face, his wrists, his finger joints and ankles. They had drained the last blood from his cheeks. They had also helped themselves to one of his teeth, though Pym did not discover this immediately, because Axel had his lips tight shut, and one twig-like finger raised to them in warning, while he waved the other at the wall of Pym's hotel bedroom, indicating microphones at work. They had smashed his right eyelid, too, which drooped over its parent eye like a cocked hat, adding to his piratical appearance. But his coat, for all that, still hung over his shoulders like a musketeer's cape. His moustache flourished, and he had inherited a marvellous pair of boots from somewhere, rich as timber, with soles like the running boards of a vintage car.
"Magnus Richard Pym," he demanded, with theatrical gruffness.
"Yes,"
said Pym, after a couple of unsuccessful attempts to speak.
"You are charged with the crimes of espionage, provocation of a people, incitement to treason and murder. Also sabotage on behalf of an imperialist power."
Still slouched languidly in his chair, Axel drove his hands together with an improbable vigour, producing a thwack that echoed round the great bedroom, and no doubt impressed the microphones. After it, he offered the prolonged grunt of a man coming to terms with a heavy punch in the stomach. Delving in his jacket pocket, he then detached a small automatic pistol from the lining, and, finger to his lips again, waved it about so that Pym got a healthy sight of it.
"Face the wall,"
he barked, clambering with difficulty to his feet.
"Place your hands on your head, you fascist swine! March!"
Laying a hand gently round Pym's shoulder, Axel guided him towards the door. Pym stepped ahead of him into the gloomy corridor. two burly men in hats ignored him. "Search his room," Axel commanded them. "Find what you can, but do not remove anything. Pay attention to the typewriter, his shoes, and the lining of his suitcase. Do not leave his room until you receive orders from me personally. Walk slowly down the stairs," he told Pym, prodding him in the small of the back with a gun.
"This is an outrage," Pym said lamely. "I demand to see a British consul immediately."
At the reception desk, the female concierge sat knitting like a hag at the guillotine. Axel prodded Pym past her to a waiting car outside. A yellow cat had taken shelter underneath it. Pulling open the passenger door, Axel nodded Pym to get in, and, having shooed the cat into the gutter, climbed in after him and started the engine.
"If you collaborate completely, you will not be harmed,"
Axel announced in his official voice, indicating a patch of crude perforations in the dashboard.
"If you attempt to escape, you will be shot."
"This is a ridiculous and scandalous act," Pym muttered. "My government will insist that those responsible be punished." But once again, his words had none of the confident ring they had possessed in the cozy barrack hut in Argyle, where he and his colleagues had practiced the skills of resisting interrogation.
"You have been watched from the moment you arrived here," said Axel loudly. "All your movements and contacts have been observed by the protectors of the people. You have no alternative but to make an immediate admission of your guilt on all charges."
"The free world will see this senseless act as the latest evidence of the brutality of the Czech regime," Pym declared, with increasing strength. Axel nodded approvingly. The streets were empty, the old houses also. They entered what had once been a rich suburb of patrician villas. Sprawling hedges hid the lower windows. The iron gateways, wide enough to ride a coach through, were blocked with ivy and barbed wire.
"Get out," Axel commanded.
The evening was young and beautiful. The full moon shed a white, unearthly light. Watching Axel lock the car, Pym smelt hay and heard the clamour of insects. Axel guided him down a narrow path between two gardens until they came to a gap in the yew hedge to his right. Grabbing Pym's wrist, he led him through it. They were standing on the terrace of what had once been a great garden. A many-towered castle lifted into the sky behind them. Ahead, almost lost to a thicket of roses, stood a decrepit summer house. Axel wrestled with the door, but it refused to yield.
"Kick it for me, Sir Magnus," he said. "This is Czechoslovakia."
Pym drove his foot against the panel. The door gave. They stepped inside. On a rusted table stood the familiar bottle of vodka and a tray of bread and gherkins. Grey stuffing was bleeding from the ripped covers of the wicker chairs.
"You are a very dangerous friend, Sir Magnus," Axel complained, as he stretched out his thin legs and surveyed his fine boots. "Why, in God's name, couldn't you have used an alias? Sometimes I think you have been put on earth in order to be my black angel."
"They said I would be better being me," Pym replied stupidly, as Axel twisted the cap from the vodka bottle. "They call it natural cover." For a long time after that, Axel appeared unable to think of anything useful to say at all, and Pym did not feel it was his place to interrupt his captor's reverie. They were sitting, legs parallel and shoulder to shoulder, like a retired couple on the beach. Below them, squares of cornfield stretched towards a forest. A heap of broken cars, more than Pym had ever seen on the Czech roads, littered the lower end of the garden. Bats wheeled decorously in the moonlight.
"Do you know this is my aunt's house?" said Axel.
"Well, no, I didn't actually," said Pym.
"Well, it was. My aunt was a witty woman. She once described to me how she broke the news to her father that she wished to marry my uncle. 'But why do you want to marry him?' said her father. 'He has no money. He is very small, and you are small too. You will have small children. He is like the encyclopedias you make me buy you every year. They look pretty, but once you have opened them and seen inside, you don't bother with them anymore.' He was wrong. Their children were large, and she was happy."
He scarcely paused.
"They want me to blackmail you, Sir Magnus. That is the only good news I have for you."
"Who do?" said Pym.
"The aristos I work for."
They think I should show you the photographs of the two of us coming out of the barn together in Austria, and play you the recordings of our conversations. They say I should wave that IOU in your face that you signed to me for the $200 we tricked out of memory for your father. How did you answer them? Said Pym. I said I would. They don't read Thomas Mann, these guys. They're very crude. This is a crude country, as you no doubt noticed in your journeys. Not at all, said Pym. I love it. Axel drank some vodka and stared into the hills. And you people don't make it any better. Your hateful little department has been seriously interfering in the running of my country. What are you? Some kind of American butler? What are you doing? Framing our officials, sowing suspicion, and seducing our intellectuals? Why do you cause people to be beaten unnecessarily, when a few years in prison would be enough? Do they teach you no reality over there? Have you no reality at all, Sir Magnus? I didn't know the firm was doing that, said Pym. Doing what? Interfering, causing people to be tortured. That must be a different section. Ours is just a sort of postal service for small agents. Axel sighed. Maybe they're not doing it. Maybe I have been brainwashed by our own stupid propaganda these days. Maybe I'm blaming you unfairly. Cheers. Cheers, said Pym. So, what will they find in your room? Axel asked, when he had lit himself a cigar and puffed at it several times. Pretty well everything, I suppose. What's everything? Secret inks? Film? Film from your agents? Yes. Developed? I assume not. From the dead letter box in Pisek? Yes. Then I wouldn't bother to develop it. It's cheap peddler material. Money? A bit, yes. How much? $5,000. Code books? A couple. Anything I might have forgotten? No atom bomb? There's a concealed camera. Is that the talcum powder tin? If you peel the paper off the lid, it makes a lens. Anything else? A silk escape map in one of my neckties. Axel drew on his cigar again, his thoughts seemingly far away. Suddenly he drove his fist onto the iron table. We have got to get ourselves out of this, Sir Magnus, he exclaimed angrily. We have got to get ourselves out. We've got to rise in the world. We've got to help each other until we become aristos ourselves, and we can kick the other bastards goodbye. He stared into the gathering darkness. You make it so difficult for me, you know that. Sitting in that prison, I had bad thoughts about you. You make it very, very difficult to be your friend. I don't see why.
Oh, he doesn't see why. He does not see that when the bold Sir Magnus Pym applies for a business visa, even the poor Czechs can look in their card index and discover there was a gentleman of the same name who was a fascist, imperialist, militarist spy in Austria, and that a certain running dog named Axel was his fellow conspirator.
His anger reminded Pym of the days of his fever in Bern. His voice had acquired the same unpleasant edge.
Are you really so ignorant of the manners of the country you are spying on, that you do not understand what it means these days for a man like me even to have been in the same continent as a man like you, let alone his fellow conspirator in a spying game? Do you really not know that in this world of whisperers and accusers, I may literally die of you? You've read George Orwell, haven't you? These are the people who can rewrite yesterday's weather.
I know, said Pym. Do you know also, then, that I may be fatally contaminated like all those poor agents and informers you are showering with money and instructions? Do you not know that you are delivering them to the scaffold, unless they belong to us already? You know at least what they will do with you, I assume, unless I make them hear me, these aristos of mine, if we can't satisfy their appetites by other means. They mean to arrest you and parade you before the world's press with your stupid agents and associates. They plan to have another show trial, hang some people,